I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on what sci-fi and fantasy are and are not saying about the world around us. I finished Ursula Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness a couple of weeks ago, and I went back to her introduction to frame today's conversation. She writes, "Science fiction is not predictive, it is descriptive." And Le Guin adds a few paragraphs later, "Prediction is the business of prophets, clairvoyants, and futurologists. It's not the business of novelists. A novelist's business is lying." I'll ask my guests about that. But we're also talking today about fantasy literature, too. Why are we drawn to those contemporary myths and legends that turn up in fantasy? Novelist Kazuo Ishiguro told Wired magazine last year, "These are tools that have been used ever since people sat around the campfire as cavemen. The ancient Greeks used it, the Romans used it, Scandinavian folktales, Japanese folktales, European folktales. We've used them all along. Why have we suddenly gotten rather snobbish and sneery about it in just the last few years?" So think about that. And as our writers join us today, I want to hear from you. Whether you're a longtime admirer and reader of science fiction or fantasy, or maybe you've just discovered it, how does it enrich your understanding of the world around you? And what truths does it tell to you, as the best fiction does? So I want to hear from you. If you love fantasy, you love science fiction, I want to talk to you and have you talk to us about what it reveals to you about the world we're living in today. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis at nprnews.org/live. And I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Daniel Jose Older, is a novelist whose books include Shadow Shaper. I've just learned that he's actually going to be in the Twin Cities on March 1st. Is that right, Daniel?
That's correct. I'm very excited.
Well, this is great. So I wish I was going to meet you in person, but I'm glad you're coming. And thanks so much for being part of the show today. Good to have you.
It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Anne Leckie is with us. She's a novelist whose books include Ancillary Mercy, and she's with us from St. Louis. And Anne, I suppose you're not coming to the Twin Cities anytime soon, but it's good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, really good to have you. Anne, as you can hear, I'm talking about science fiction and fantasy. Well, I need to know what the difference is, and I think our listeners who maybe aren't immersed in the literature need to know what the difference is.
I hear Daniel laughing.
Yeah, we're both laughing at that one.
Okay,
that's a contentious conversation.
Let's start with that. What would you say, Anne?
And I'm sure Daniel already knows this and is thinking this, the best way to start a really knockdown, drag-out argument is to ask someone to define the difference between science fiction and fantasy.
Okay.
I kind of feel like they're sort of two sides of the same coin, or sides isn't even right, two shades on the same continuum that are working with material that's maybe not completely 100% recognizably realistic, but in ways that can short-circuit our assumptions about the world around us and tell stories that will give us a different perspective on things. But one of the ways of doing that is to set things in a sort of nominal past where things are sort of mystical, and to draw very self-consciously on older stories, on myths and legends. Another way is to set it in a sort of theoretical, boxed-off sort of future and tell the story where instead of using magic or mysticism, although you can obviously mix these up, to think about how technology is affecting things. And there's a huge gradation in between. And I think the fights happen because somebody will value one or the other of those shades on the continuum and
right.
insist on a difference. But really, they're very much doing similar work.
Wow.
I don't think there's actually a huge difference.
And that was really well said. And Daniel, I thought I was going to get a lecture like, what, you don't understand the bright line between science fiction and fantasy?
Oh, I'm very anti-bright line.
None of us do.
Okay, so Daniel, what would you say about this?
Well, she really did it right there. That was beautiful. I agree. It's a spectrum. I think that's what really she got at, which is perfect. It's so complex because, I mean, I think people try to narrow it down to, like, science fiction is somehow theoretically possible, right? Even if this technology doesn't exist right now, it could. So it's grounded in some kind of scientific explanation, whatever element, you know, is going on in the story, whether it's space travel or robots or AI. Whereas fantasy, there's some level to it that is somehow in the realm of what we consider to be impossible, whether it's, you know, dragons or you know, mythical monsters or magic. And then, as Anne perfectly said, that gets very hazy, right? There is no real clear line about what's actually possible, as we've learned very clearly this year in politics, right? So here we are, you know, trying to redefine that constantly. And I think if you talk to different, you know, that's also a very cultural question, right? You know, I believe in ancestors helping us out. That's most people in the world actually do. But that's considered an impossibility, right? Because ghosts are in the realm of fantasy. So who you ask really also determines what your answer is going to be on that question.
Daniel, what do you think about what Ishiguro said about kind of the snobbishness that some readers bring to the idea of fantasy, that maybe they wouldn't to science fiction?
Yeah, I actually think science fiction and fantasy are sort of sisters in that receiving end of snobbishness.
Do you?
Sometimes in different ways. Like, sure, there are science fiction people who sneer at fantasy because, oh, it could never be, or whatever. You hear it. But I think more than anything, we hear a lot of quote-unquote literary writers, you know, with fancy degrees. And I have a fancy degree, whatever. But, you know, looking at us like, because we write about monsters and goblins and spaceships, somehow we're not up to par. We're not telling, you know, a deep story about humanity. When the truth is, science fiction and fantasy are full of deep stories about humanity, and literature is full of great literature, quote unquote, is full of monsters and spaceships.
And I think we've probably won that. We've kind of won that battle, or we're winning it, because I think it's true that there are people who do still do that, but there are also quite a lot of literature professors who will teach science fiction and acknowledge it. And a lot of literary writers will say very plainly, Michael Chabon, he's one of us, right?
Right.
And so I think that is kind of declining, and all to the good. But I'm not sure what caused it to begin with. There was a trend there. There was something that happened.
And it's funny because when we look back, you know, like Frankenstein is in the realm of literature, right? But that's the beginning of science fiction, a woman who really started a new genre in a lot of ways. And that goes on and on.
I'm so glad you mentioned Frankenstein. Daniel, I'm so glad you mentioned Frankenstein, written, of course, by Mary Wollstonecraft. And Shelley, yes.
Yeah.
I want to mention that I'm getting all these tweets from guys. Hey, that's great. I know there's a lot of guys who read science fiction and fantasy. But I want to hear from the women who are reading science fiction and fantasy as well. If as a happening kind of chick, you read sci-fi and fantasy, I want to hear from you today on Twitter, okay, or on the phones. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, NPRnews.org/live, on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Steph, off the page.
Chris says,
guy or gal?
I don't know. Let's have Chris be a gal.
Okay.
I read the collected short stories of Arthur C. Clarke this past fall. In his story, I Remember Babylon from 1960, he told of a Soviet-Chinese plot to brainwash Americans through satellite broadcasting of porn, sensationalist news, and violent entertainment.
Wow. Okay. Mm. So Steven says on Twitter, steampunk is a good example of sci-fi mixed with fantasy, and a call here from Larry in Minneapolis. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hey.
The thing about science fiction, and I read science fiction pretty much exclusively as my leisure reading. I probably have 500 novels not yet read sitting on my shelf.
Well,
authors I like.
Wow. That's exciting.
But the reason I like science fiction is it tells me that we're going to find a way to overcome all the problems that exist on this planet, and we're going to still be here 500 years, 10,000 years, whatever term you want to set it in the future. That's the reason why. I mean, my tagline in my email is a quote from Sloan, I forget his first name, of the Sloan Kettering Institute. Back in 1948, he said, my interest is in the future because I'm going to spend the rest of my life there.
Okay, so Daniel, it's a optimistic, hopeful portrait and genre for Larry. Do you agree?
That's fascinating, because I think so much of the post-apocalyptic literature that's really come up in the past decade, and what a grim portrayal of the future we have from so much of it. But there is also, I mean, he's right. There's a lot of different branches of it. And I think that's kind of what's amazing about it, right? If we're looking for hope, we can find it in science fiction. If we're looking for the stark and difficult truths, we can find it there. And let's shout out Octavia Butler, whose Parable of the Sower series really spoke, you know, was doing post-apocalyptic teenagers in the post-apocalyptic world way before the Hunger Games came up, and really telling us truths about what's happening right now, too, which is really the power, I think, of looking into the future is also seeing the present.
And is it okay that I'm asking to hear from some women who read this? Because I don't think we... I know there's a discussion going on about diversity and a lot of different shapes of diversity in the genre. But I also don't think that enough women get a shot to write it and get a shot to talk about it. And we don't hear from enough of the readers. I'd just be interested in your view.
Yeah, I kind of feel like women have always been writing and reading science fiction, probably in larger numbers than people realize.
Wow.
And over and over, the women who read and write science fiction have sort of become repeatedly invisible. So it seems like every 10 years or so, somebody will say, oh, look at all these women writing science fiction now. Isn't this exciting? And then 10 years later, somebody will go, oh, wow, this has been such a male-dominated genre, and look at all these women. And I've watched it happen over my lifetime, and maybe I'm wrong, but I sort of extrapolate that back starting in the 20s and 30s, and that was probably happening then, that they've always been there. And so I actually, yeah, I'm all for women who read and write it should speak up and not be erased. And you know, I think a lot of times women are sort of socialized to be more polite, to defer to other people talking, and so you don't want to make a fuss. And of course, sometimes it's dangerous to make a fuss. And so maybe the women reading sometimes aren't making the noise that they could. And sometimes we're making lots of noise and people are like, oh, I don't hear anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all for that. People who are reading science fiction of all sorts should speak up and be seen so that the narrative about what science fiction is isn't anymore that exclusively, oh, it's white guys and it was all, you know, this stuff that was written in the 50s and that's what it's like.
Yes.
Because it's way more varied.
Daniel?
Yes, absolutely. All that from Mary Shelley, who we already mentioned, to Ursula Le Guin, to Anne McCaffrey, too. And then the writers who really influenced me, Octavia Butler, Tanana Reeve-Dhu, Nalo Hopkinson. And let's shout out that fantasy really changed when a wizard showed up, written by a woman, right? That's been the top seller. J.K. Rowling has changed the game in so many ways.
True.
Changed young adult fiction, changed fantasy fiction, and doesn't always get categorized into fantasy because it's young adult, but it's absolutely fantasy, and it's absolutely changed the world.
Carlin
absolutely.
Says on Twitter, I love Neil Gaiman, especially the Sandman Chronicles. Our friend Haley Bonner on Twitter says Octavia Butler. Amanda says, besides Frankenstein, I'd posit that Moby Dick is a fantasy monster story.
Oh, yeah. I completely agree.
Yeah,
I actually, in high school, I had to read Moby Dick, and I found it just dreadfully tiresome. But as an adult, I went back to read it, and I was like, all those long info dumpy chapters about whales, if you read those as though you're reading a science fiction novel, and those are about an alien species that's being encountered, suddenly the whole novel looks very different, and it's actually kind of an awesome science fiction novel.
Sure.
I don't think he wrote it that way. I doubt Melville was like, I'm going to write a science fiction novel. But it reads really interestingly if you read it from the context of being a science fiction reader.
Call here from Heather in Northfield. Hi, Heather. What are you reading, sci-fi and fantasy-wise? Yeah.
Rereading a bunch of Christmas sci-fi novels. The Doomsday Book by Connie Willis.
Mm.
She also has a set of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Set around Christmas time. She's wonderful.
Okay. Good.
So, and as far as one of the first women sci-fi novelists was Catherine L. Moore, was married to Henry Nutter, and she wrote The Vintage Season. It's a short story you'll find in a whole lot of anthologies.
Yeah.
About the most beautiful spring of the year, and it brought back this spring was probably the most beautiful spring we've had in Minnesota, and I'm looking around looking for the time travelers and waiting what disaster is awaiting us.
Love your call, Heather. That's really good. Somebody who is tweeting is Starship Doty Ann says, huge fan of ancillary series. Complex themes, justice versus corruption, unintended consequences, consciousness, morality. You're cramming all that into Ann. That's really nice. Steph, off the page.
Jenna says, I'm a female who loves what Margaret Atwood calls speculative fiction, which I think works well. Oh, my page just updated. There we go. I did a master's thesis on The Handmaid's Tale. I love Atwood's Orcs and Crake, and I find dystopian and apocalyptic fiction can often speak to our reality more than regular fiction can. And she also added, can we talk about Game of Thrones?
Can we talk about Game of Thrones, Daniel? What would you say?
I love it.
You mentioned how Harry Potter turned this whole thing upside down. What about Game of Thrones?
Absolutely. I think what really strikes me about Game of Thrones, and one of the things I really just adore about it, is that it's really world-based storytelling, right? So we're used to this singular character narrative, right? The one who will save us, the one ring to rule them all, the chosen one. But here we have a story about a world and the politics and the divisions and the warfare that happens in that world. And I think most people are really invested in the world more than any one character. And that's part of how he gets away with killing so many characters, which is, you know, an amazing thing that he gets to do. But I know I keep reading because I'm really invested in Westeros and finding out how it will all play out. Plus, there's really cool dragons.
And you can't ignore that. Right?
Gotta have the dragons.
Gotta have the dragons. Let's see. Terry says, sci-fi fantasy chick for more than 30 years. 13-year-old daughter reads it, too. Love all the female authors now, but Patrick Rothfuss, did I pronounce that right, is my fave. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a piece about you at Slate.com and the pressure from within the sci-fi community to kind of conform to this idea about what science fiction should be. And the writer said this, and I want to know if you agree with this. At the core of their complaints is a fear of losing power within the science fiction community and losing control over what it means to be a science fiction writer. But they cloak their arguments and appeals to transcendental virtues and accusations of snobbery. Now, you may have long since, you know, pushed this off, but is there still some of this present in the community of writers?
Absolutely, some of that present. Absolutely. That is still with us. That was referring to a specific dust up at the time, but it's still sort of a slow motion dust up that's happening. I think it's absolutely true. And I think it speaks to how powerful stories are to us. I know the caller who said that one of the things that they liked was how hopeful and optimistic the story was that science fiction could be. And that's, I think we learn how to organize the world around us by the narratives that we have in inventory. We tell stories to understand the world. And so when you're used to stories telling you that the world is like a certain way, whether or not it really matches the world around you, that's a powerful thing framing your sense of self, your sense of identity, your sense of how the world ought to be. When that predominant narrative changes, when suddenly you're being fed narratives that are challenging those, that can be very upsetting and very disorienting. And when you're the person who the narratives have been serving, suddenly the narrative saying, well, maybe you're not the center, you do experience that as a lack of power, as a loss of power. And I think that's part of what's going on. There are other more complicated things going on, some of which we do see manifesting more generally recently. But I do think that absolutely is a factor in that.
And Daniel, not that this is only happening in science fiction and fantasy literature. I know this is an issue throughout publishing. But do you think it's more pronounced in these genres?
Yeah, I think Anne put it really, really beautifully as far as thinking through this idea of narrative and how it shapes both how we see ourselves and how we see the world. And there is a shift, and it's exciting. And the shift has happened because writers have been speaking out, writers who haven't always or have really never had an opportunity to really have the microphone or the megaphone have been fighting very hard and long to get to this moment where we're starting to more. And it is shaking things up, and it's making people who have always been very comfortable, very uncomfortable. So we see a backlash, and there's a long history of that, of course. And there's also a long history of narratives, as Anne said, centering very particular people, usually straight white men. And now, you know, we're getting these different stories and these counter narratives, including a lot of amazing. Tor.com has put out a lot of really fantastic Lovecraftian counter narratives told by characters who were demonized in the books.
Oh,
in his writing,
really?
Right? Because he was, of course, a notorious racist and wrote a lot about monsters and kind of made monsters out of people of color, mostly erased women entirely. And now, you know, Victor Laval has this amazing novel out, The Ballad of Black Tom, a novella. And there's just more and more of these that are like not retellings, they're counter narratives, telling whole new stories, but using some of the racist past as a jumping off point and then fighting it in a beautiful way.
If you've just gotten in on this conversation, you hear us talking about science fiction and fantasy literature, a lot of different dimensions of it. Daniel Jose Older is one of our guests. He's his books include Shadow Shaper and Salsa Nocturne, and he's going to be in the Twin Cities on March 1st. And Anne Leckie is with us. She's a novelist. Her books include Ancillary, Mercy, and she's with us today from St. Louis. And I'm talking to you this morning, full phone lines here, so you can probably get in on the page or you can get on Twitter here, but I'm asking you about whether you're a longtime admirer, reader of science fiction or fantasy, or you've just discovered it. I want you to talk to me a bit about how reading the literature really enriches your understanding of the world around you now. Yeah, I want to hear about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Terry says, when I was younger, I kept my love of the genre to myself. No girls I knew liked fantasy. It was just me and boy dragons and dungeons players. Step off the page.
Jeanette says, for me as a scientist, science fiction helps me stimulate my imagination so that I can incorporate that inspiration into my own work. If we imagine what the future could be, we are driven to make it truth.
Hey, Daniel, I'm going to be around on March 1st. Why don't you come into the studio while you're here and we can chat about
Absolutely.
Your newest book or whatever else comes to our minds. Could we do that?
That'd be terrific.
Great.
Let's do it.
Okay. To the phones to Rachel in Minneapolis. Hey, Rachel, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had to call in when you specifically invited women callers.
Yes.
After I saw the recent movie Arrival, I was so mesmerized by how I think it plays with themes as metaphors, but that's just my interpretation. I usually don't go out of my way to buy science fiction, but I then had to get the short story. So I bought the Ted Chiang collection, Stories of Your Life and Others. And so far I've read and reread the story that Arrival is based on, which I think is called Story of Your Life.
Mm.
And I went back to see Arrival 2 more times. I usually don't do that. I just think it's so deep, and the story, in a way, they change some, I don't want to give anything away, they change some key plot points
mm-hmm.
about free will and human stuff, but I want to keep rereading it, because I think the physics in the short story get kind of metaphorical, too,
mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if the rest of the panel thinks that the rest of the short story book is worth reading.
Yeah. So Rachel, I'm getting, just one second, Anne. Rachel, I'm getting the sense that you don't usually read science fiction or fantasies, but this seeing Arrival really spurred your interest. Is that right?
Well, I thought so, but then, well, only about science fiction, because okay. I would read and see the Harry Potter things and early teachers got me into Narnia.
Okay.
And, But I honestly didn't think of myself as affirmatively seeking science fiction. I have a lot of friends who are really into Star Trek and Star Wars, but I just experienced it vicariously. And seeing this alien visiting movie where it's not a shoot 'em up action movie, but more exploring themes really spoke to me.
Yeah. Okay. Anne, sorry to interrupt.
Say? Please finish reading the collection. Ted Chiang is one of the best short fiction writers working in science fiction and fantasy today. The rest of the collection will be fabulous. Absolutely finish it. And I also wanted to say that I think the sort of public image of science fiction as being shoot 'em ups, although I like an explosion as much as the next girl, science fiction is sort of doesn't have it's not entirely a fair portrayal of it. Science fiction and fantasy run very much on literalized metaphor. That's where it gets a lot of its power. And so I thought that was really interesting that you talked about that. If that's something that you enjoy, you may well find a lot of power in other science fiction. It's absolutely worth exploring. But do finish reading the Ted Chiang. He's wonderful.
So, Anne, do you think science fiction is still a little too interested in spaceships and galaxies, and maybe fantasy is still too interested in medieval Europe and kings and queens?
As a person whose trilogy was about spaceships and galactic empires, I don't think I can say that that science fiction's too interested in spaceships and shoot 'em ups. I do kind of feel that maybe fantasy could profit from drawing on something other than. Not just other than medieval Europe, but something other than a sort of sanitized, conventional, cut-down version of medieval Europe that many people think is accurate but actually isn't.
Good.
I think that I don't think that it's healthy to say what a literature should or shouldn't do. I think it's more helpful to point out that it can do so much more than its run-of-the-mill versions can do. So you can do a medieval fantasy that really explores interesting stuff. 9 out of 10 of them probably aren't doing that. That's okay. You need candy, right? But you can do more interesting things. 9 out of 10 of the shoot 'em up space operas are just about blowing things up, and that's awesome. But it can totally do more, even with those explosions. So yes. I'm more interested in saying what it can do than saying what it should or shouldn't do.
Okay, Daniel, a call for you from Mike in White Bear Lake. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for waiting.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Well, this won't make me too popular.
That's okay.
With you, but I just cannot get into the genre. In fact, every time I see a new release or a new film that's all CGI related, and I roll my eyes and go, here we go again. I just prefer the humanities of the real world. And I know that there are some themes that transcend, but I just would like your insight as to why am I the way I am.
Yeah, Daniel, this is why he's right for you. Make your closing argument here.
Mike, I don't know the answer to that question. Oh. I don't know you. But I will just say that I think that there's what we've just been talking about, this idea of metaphor and this idea that you can blow up spaceships and have dragons. You can have dragons blowing up spaceships and still say something deep about the world. I think it's important to sort of let yourself enjoy stuff and don't let the CGI get in the way. But I also want to say I hear you on that, too. I'm a big fan of the original Star Wars trilogy, in part because you can feel the humanity coming through Frank Oz and directly into that, you know, latex monster so much more clearly than you can with these, you know, digitally constructed zeros and one monsters, in my opinion. I think they've been getting a lot better since that 1, 2, 3 edition. But, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I think it's worth looking at sci-fi and fantasy and trying to enjoy it and also take in the depth of what it has to offer, because it's multitudes. There's so much there.
Danny says on Twitter, dystopian fiction by way of Octavia Butler teaches us to come together or be taken over. When apparent stability disintegrates as it must, people tend to give in to fear and depression, to need and greed. When no influence is strong enough to unify people. I think a quote from Octavia Butler. Steph, off the page.
Sue says the trilogy I am loving is the Tierling trilogy. The first Queen of the Tierling is a good read about a woman queen in a dystopian world who makes things right.
Mm. To Neil, listening in Paris, France. Hi, Neil.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to say that I'm a huge fan of Neal Stephenson, and
me too.
It's amazing. He's he meticulously documents every subject that he's doing in like 1,200 page novels. That like Cryptonomicon, where you learn everything about cryptography and the history of cryptography to present day cryptographic practices, or his recent novel, Seven Eves, which is like the moon explodes, and then what do you do? And then he delves into all possible technologies that would have to be employed to be able to survive such a circumstance. So, I mean, and he does historical speculative fiction and all kinds of things, but it's pretty amazing, and I think I benefit a lot from that kind of science fiction, in that I just learn a great deal.
Daniel, it sounds like you share Neil's interest in Neil Stephenson.
I love Snow Crash so much. I think pretty much everything he's done is great. Snow Crash is a book that perfectly exemplifies things blowing up and really deep stuff happening. And that's like what's so strong about it. It's a really fast-paced action-adventure story. It's a future dystopia type thing. There's samurai swords and there's tech and all kinds of cool stuff. And there's also, it harks back to mythology and all this deep thing. And then just real quick, speaking of mythology, I also really think that's really the basis of so much of fantasy today. And when I was a kid, the Iliad was my favorite book ever. And I still love it so much. Yeah, I was 11 and I couldn't stop reading it. And but look at that. That's a world where it's a given that these monsters and gods walk amongst us and are meddling with human affairs, right? It's just understood. And it's this whole network of stories that come together to do this very powerful world-building work. And then we have all these epics of people, you know, going to war with each other and falling in love. The gods are falling in love with humans. It's a mess, right? But it's a great mess. It's great literature.
And I started the show here talking about having finished Ursula Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness. I didn't ask you if you've read it recently or how long it's been since you've read it.
It's been a couple of years. And in fact, I don't know if you know, like, the most famous thing about my trilogy is the pronoun use. And many people assumed that I had written it.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Almost everybody who's heard of it knows that, if they know nothing else. A lot of people assumed that I was writing in reaction to The Left Hand of Darkness or influenced by The Left Hand of Darkness. But I actually didn't read that until I was nearly done with the first novel.
Wow.
So I've actually read it two or three times within the past couple of years. It's really an amazing book. It's really incredible. Yeah.
Here's something that I made a little note of and then went back to it at the end of the novel. There's this paragraph early on in the novel where they're talking about what patriotism is, and I was struck by how relevant that is. It's just astonishingly relevant to the discussion that we're having today. So two characters are discussing what patriotism is, and one says, "No, I don't mean love when I say patriotism. I mean fear, the fear of the other, and its expressions are political, not poetical. Hate, rivalry, aggression." Boy, she summed up the political conversation that we're having today in like three sentences there. And that is the power of really great literature. That's why I was asking listeners, what does it tell you? What does this genre tell you about the world we're living in today? Would you speak to that for a minute?
I find that is really super powerful. And you can look back and say, gosh, she wrote this decades ago.
Right.
She wrote that, 40, 50 years ago, and it's speaking about today. But I think that speaks about where we are today is a result of processes that started hundreds of years ago that have been continuing on for decades. It's the culmination of things that we've forgotten about because they happened so long ago, but they're still influencing our behavior. Le Guin herself has said science fiction doesn't predict the future, it talks about the present. But our present is still part of someone else's future, and that present that she was writing in is our past that produced our future. And so those things, it's all sort of very it's all very interconnected. I think a lot of times in retrospect, you go back and look at a science fiction novel and say, wow, that was really speaking to the time. You go back and look at Campbell's Who Goes There, which is the original for The Thing, where you have the alien that looks like other people and you don't know, is the person next to you your enemy? And you can say, oh, that's about the sort of anti-communist paranoia of the 50s. But he actually is writing that sort of just before that begins to sort of take hold. If you're not doing it consciously, you're saying things about the time that you live in that can be very profound that you can't really see until you get some kind of distance on it.
This is why when you see, as you just said, Anne, when you see Le Guin say science fiction isn't predictive, it's descriptive, I think we fall into that predictive trap because so much of what science fiction is saying about the future is so relevant. years
absolutely.
On.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Call here from Finn in Minneapolis. Hey, Finn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What'd you want to say?
So I also just read The Left Hand of Darkness about a week ago.
We
and
were
I
reading it together.
It.
Good.
Yeah, and then I picked up The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin and read it and loved it as well.
Uh-huh.
And one thing it made me think about is I love the way she plays with this kind of middle ground between dystopia and utopia.
Mm.
It's always someone's utopia, but someone's dystopia, whether it's the two kind of Cold
point.
War worlds in Left Hand of Darkness. And that made me think about, I used to have a friend, and we both read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and one of us, I read it as a dystopia, but he read it as a utopia. And it really harkened back to this, especially with current relevance, and we're looking at, you know, in the wake of this election, it kind of begs the question, you know, what is someone's dystopia? Is that, you know, half the country's utopia?
Boy, I think I could do a whole show on that, Finn. That's a really good idea. Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. And I hate to end this conversation, but Daniel, we'll continue it in March when you're here. I'm
Absolutely.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And the next time you're in the Twin Cities, please let me know and let's chat on air, okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Really good to have you here.